Chancellor, there are two issues relating to sexual conflict that have dominated the local news. Landon Gamble, a sophomore at UNC, has claimed that her boyfriend sexually assaulted her physically and verbally. I know you can't talk about the specific case, so I'm going to just do this one paragraph background. She took her case in front of the honor court. You may correct me if I have the facts wrong. She took her case in front of the honor court, which ruled that he was guilty of verbal harassment but not physical harassment. Gamble then accused the honor court of not being prepared to handle the case. She said that inappropriate questions were asked of her during the course of all that, and that students should not be ruling on these matters. Is that generally accurate?
Well, there's one piece of it. I mean, as you said, I'm not going to comment on specific cases, but I think it's important to point out that our processes for handling sexual assault cases are evolving. And we've gone from a time when the cases were handled by the honor court to where the cases were handled with what we called an interim procedure, which was a transition to what we have now, which is a system where the cases are handled by both by student, staff, and faculty. And some of those cases fell in that middle period that we were making the transition. So it's a little bit oversimplified to just say the honor court, because we have removed sexual assault from the what most longtime Carolina people would think of as the honor court.
And that's been since this occurred.
Well, all of this was in this fluid time as we were making this change.
Well, I think first of all, the first question has to do with the honor court itself. I remember when we were in school, it seemed to me that it was focused on keeping students from cheating in class. You weren't supposed to plagiarize or cheat. And as students, we vowed not to cheat and report students that did. And I don't remember anything else about it, but it certainly today, the honor court is, I don't know how many thousands of words it is, but the honor code book is 55 pages of, and it's very, I mean, this is obviously looks as if it was written by lawyers. So the scope of the honor court itself has expanded. As a matter of fact, one of the things that jumped out at me as we looked at it is that the honor court actually has jurisdiction over disruptive or intimidating behavior that willfully abuses or disparages or otherwise interferes with another student and so forth. It seems to me that the honor court has significantly broadened what it can regulate. Is that appropriate?
Well, that's I think that it is absolutely appropriate for the university to have high standards for the behavior of its members of its community. And so I think that a lot of the non-academic things that are there are appropriately considered when we talk about what it means to be a contributing member of the community. But I do agree with a lot of the comments that have been made that having a totally student-run honor court is maybe an idea that was manageable when we first came up with it, which was 130 years ago. But that now, as I look around the country, the number of completely student-run honor courts is pretty small. And I think that one of the things that I hope our community will consider is whether it might be time to rethink the complete role that students have. And this is a very controversial topic. There are a lot of former student attorney generals who get very upset when they hear me say this, but I think chancellors have struggled over the years with the honor court and its independence. And, you know, it's one of these areas where you can't win, because if something goes wrong in the honor court, the public is expecting that the chancellor can intervene and correct that. But all of the sort of former student attorney generals and honor court golden fleece crowd who love the honor court and think it's the sacrosanct thing don't think that the chancellor should intervene. And that, again, is another one of these things that I think we've taken on that's unsustainable. So I think we need to think about what the proper role for students in this is. And, again, you know, just as the Knight Commission crowd is upset with me for saying things about how we govern intercollegiate athletics, I think there are certain folks who are uncomfortable that I've been saying these sorts of things about the honor court. But, again, I think this is one of these things that needs to come out in the open and people need to discuss.
Well, the question really also has to do with what legal authority an honor court can have, because it's not really constituted by the city or the state or the federal government. It's constituted by the campus itself. But it among the issues in the instrument of student judicial government, it includes things that are actually breaking the law, things like fighting and stealing. They're public laws that would apply to that. And would those, it seems to me that that's murky territory. Should issues of that kind not be directly referred to the laws of the city and the state?
Well, again, that's something that, I mean, the way it's done now, the students who participate in the constant revision of that document have wanted to have included. Now, what happens in practice is that if it's pretty common for somebody to get arrested and convicted of something, and they think that they've taken care of whatever their violation was, and then they find out that there's going to be an honor court case as well. And in the abstract, I think people tend to think that that's a good thing because we want the members of our community to uphold the law, but almost everybody who gets caught up in that thing, which they refer to as double jeopardy, it's not really double jeopardy, but it's having to go through two proceedings instead of just one. Almost everybody who gets to that point thinks it's really unfair that those things are in the instrument. So, again, I think that's something that ought to be examined as part of all this.
You know, I think about the job of the chancellor, and we try to those of us who run businesses, you try to put problems in buckets. But who would have ever in 100 years ever figured out that the athletic scandal would somehow dribble over into a plagiarism scandal that would dribble over into an African-American studies thing? And so now you've got all of that makes that much more complicated. So while this is going on, you also have a broader problem. Your former dean of students, Melinda Manning, joined in the accusation, saying she was pressured to underreport sexual assault cases when she was associate dean, so pressured by the Office of the University's Counsel. In a situation of this kind, we have that going on, and somehow or another the Lauren Gamble business is all bundled together, and we've got demonstrations on the campus about whether it's a safe place to be and all of that. First of all, did you have any indication, did Melinda Manning ever come to you before she filed this lawsuit?
Before she filed the lawsuit, well, I knew that it's not a lawsuit. It's a complaint to the Office of Civil Rights.
Yes.
She didn't come to me herself, but I did know a few days before the complaint was filed that there was going to be one filed. But I certainly didn't know at the time that there was any disagreement over how we did our reporting in the Clery Act. But the Department of Education has sent a team down to review that, and we're cooperating with them. And if they indicate that we need to change the way we're making those reports, we'll certainly do it.
So while she was in that dean's role or the assistant dean's role, that never came to your attention?
No, it did not.
Yeah.
It's a hard challenge, and we want to get it right. And whatever the federal government says about how we need to do it, we'll do. But the problem that you have is there are multiple places where you get information from, the campus police department, from student affairs, from the local police department, and you try to piece all these together and come up with a number, and that's a bureaucratically challenging thing to do. And so if we can get some guidance from the federal government about how they want us to do that, I think that'll be great.
Well, just as you could not be responsible for everything that was happening in the athletic department, you also can't be responsible for the actions. How many employees you have?
Well, we have 3,000 faculty, 8,000 employees in the staff, and another 11,000 in the hospital.
And how many of them in supervisory roles?
Oh, well, a good bit of them. I'd have to I don't know that number off the top of my head.
An awful lot. Is it generally something that you worry about, the issues of sexual harassment?
Yes. I worry about this is something that I've worried about all along, and we can debate for and people will for years about whether we should spend so much time arguing about intercollegiate athletics. But this is something that goes directly to the safety of the students and their academic success. And this is something we worked hard on before this complaint came along. And we've worked even harder on this semester because there's been more attention on it. But sexual assault, mental health issues, prescription drugs, the isolation that is created by the internet, these are all major issues that face us in student affairs. And they face us here and at universities around the country. And these are major, important areas for administrators to work on. And while, I felt I spent too much time working on athletics, I don't feel that I've spent too much time working on this. There's no such thing as spending too much time on this. This is at the heart of our being able to do our job.